Chapter 5. It was necessary for Bob Arctor to be out of his house for a period of time in order that it be properly, which meant unerringly, bugged, phone included, even though the phone lines were tapped elsewhere. Usually, the practice consisted of observing the house involved until everyone was seen to leave it in such a fashion as to suggest that they were not going to return soon. The authorities sometimes had to wait for days or even several weeks. Finally, if nothing else worked, a pretext was arranged. The residents were informed that a fumigator or some such shuck personality was going to be coming in for a whole afternoon, and everybody had to get lost until, say, 6 p.m. But in this case, the suspect, Robert Arctor, obligingly left his house, taking his two roommates with him, to go check out a cephalochromoscope they could use on loan until Barris had his working again. The three of them were seen to drive off in Arctor's car, looking serious and determined. Then, later on, at a convenient point, which was a payphone at a gas station, using the audio grid of his scramble suit, Fred called in to report that definitely nobody would be home the rest of that day. He'd overheard the three men deciding to cruise all the way down to San Diego in search of a cheap, ripped-off cephalochromoscope that some dude had for sale for around $50, a smack freak price. At that price, it was worth the long drive and all the time. Also, this gave the authorities the opportunity to do a little illegal searching above and beyond what their undercover people did when no one was looking. They got to pull out bureau drawers to see what was taped to the backs. They got to pull apart pole lamps to see if hundreds of tabs sprang out. They got to look down inside toilet bowls to see what sort of little packets and toilet paper were lodged out of sight where the running water would automatically flush them. They got to look in the freezer compartment of the refrigerator to see if any of the packages of frozen peas and beans actually contained frozen dope, slyly mismarked. Meanwhile, the complicated holo scanners were mounted, with officers seating themselves in various places to test the scanners out. The same with the audio ones. But the video part was more important and took more time. And, of course, the scanner should never be visible. It took skill to so mount them. A number of locations had to be tried. The technicians who did this got paid well, because if they screwed up and a holo scanner got detected later on by an occupant of the premises, then the occupants, all of them, would know they had been penetrated and were under scrutiny and cool their activities. And in addition, they would sometimes tear off the whole scanning system and sell it. It had proven difficult in the courts, Bob Arctor reflected as he drove along the San Diego freeway south, to get convictions on theft and sale of electronic detection devices illegally installed in someone's residence. The police could only tack the bust on somewhere else, under another statute violation. However, the pushers, in an analogous situation, reacted directly. He recalled a case in which a heroin dealer, out to burn a chick, had planted two packets of heroin in the handle of her iron, then phoned in an anonymous tip on her to Wee Tip. Before the tip could be acted on, the chick found the heroin, but instead of flushing it, she had sold it. The police came, found nothing. They made a voice print on the phone tip and arrested the pusher for giving false information to the authorities. While out on bail, the pusher visited the chick late one night and beat her almost to death. When caught and asked why he'd put out one of her eyes and broken both her arms and several ribs, he explained that the chick had come across two packets of high-grade heroin belonging to him, sold them for a good profit, and not cut him in. Such, Arctor reflected, went the pusher mentality. He dumped off Luckman and Barris to do a scrounging number for the cephalochromoscope. This not only stranded both men and kept them from getting back to the house while the bugging installation was going on, but permitted him to check up on an individual he hadn't seen for over a month. He seldom got down this way, and the chick seemed to be doing nothing more than shooting meth two or three times a day and turning tricks to pay for it. She lived with her dealer, who was therefore also her old man. Usually Dan Mansher was gone during the day, which was good. The dealer was an addict, too, but Arctor had not been able to figure out to what. Evidently a variety of drugs. Anyhow, whatever it was, Dan had become weird and vicious, unpredictable and violent. It was a wonder the local police hadn't picked him up long ago on local disturbance of the peace infractions. Maybe they were paid off. Or, most likely, they just didn't care. These people lived in the slum housing area, among senior citizens and the other poor. Only for major crimes did the police enter the Cromwell Village series of buildings and related garbage dump, parking lots, and rubbled roads. There seemed to be nothing that contributed more to squalor than a bunch of basalt block structures designed to lift people out of squalor. He parked, found the right urine-smelling stairs, ascended into darkness, found the door of Building 4 marked G. A full can of Drano lay before the door, and he picked it up automatically, wondering how many kids played here, and remembering for a moment his own kids and the protective moves he had made on their behalf over the years. This was one now, picking up this can. He rapped against the door with it. Presently, the door lock rattled and the door opened, chained inside. The girl, Kimberly Hawkins, peered out.
Yes?
Hey, man, he said. That's me, Bob.
What do you have there?
Can of Drano, he said.
No kidding.
She unchained the door in a listless way. Her voice, too, was listless. Kimberly was down, he could see. Very down. Also, the girl had a black eye and a split lip. And as he looked around, he saw that the windows of the small, untidy apartment were broken. Shards of glass lay on the floor, along with overturned ashtrays and Coke bottles. You alone? He asked.
Yeah. Dan and I had a fight, and he split.
The girl, half Chicano, small and not too pretty, with the sallow complexion of a crystal freak, gazed down sightlessly, and he realized that her voice rasped when she spoke. Some drugs did that. Also, so did strep throat. The apartment probably couldn't be heated, not with the broken windows. He beat you up. Arctor set the can of Drano down on a high shelf over some paperback porn novels, most of them out of date.
Well, he didn't have his knife, thank God. His case knife that he carries on his belt and sheath now.
Kimberly seated herself in an overstuffed chair out of which springs stuck.
What do you want, Bob? I'm bummed. I really am.
You want him back?
Well,
she shrugged a little.
Who knows?
Arctor walked to the window and looked out. Dan Mancher would no doubt be showing up sooner or later. The girl was a source of money, and Dan knew she'd need her regular hits once her supply had run out. How long can you go? He asked.
Another day.
Can you get it anywhere else?
Yeah, but not so cheap.
What's wrong with your throat?
A cold, she said, from the wind coming in.
You should.
If I go to a doctor, she said, then he'll see. I'm on crystal. I can't go.
A doctor wouldn't care.
Sure he would.
She listened then, the sound of car pipes irregular and loud.
Is that Dan's car? A red Ford 79 Torino?
At the window, Arctor looked out onto the rubbishy lot, saw a battered red Torino stopping, its twin exhausts exhaling dark smoke, the driver's door opening.
Yes?
Kimberly locked the door, two extra locks.
He probably has his knife.
You have a phone?
No,
she said.
You should get a phone.
The girl shrugged.
He'll kill you, Arctor said.
Not now. You're here.
But later, after I'm gone.
Kimberly reseated herself and shrugged again.
After a few moments, they could hear steps outside and then a knock on the door. Then Dan, yelling for her to open the door. She yelled back no, and that someone was with her.
Okay,
Dan yelled in a high-pitched voice.
I'll slash your tires!
He ran downstairs, and Arctor and the girl watched through the broken window together as Dan Mancher, the skinny, short-haired, homosexual-looking dude waving a knife, approached her car, still yelling up to her, his words audible to everyone else in the housing area.
I'll slash your tires, your fucking tires! And then I'll fucking kill you!
He bent down and slashed first one tire and then another on the girl's old Dodge. Kimberly, suddenly aroused, sprang to the door of the apartment and frantically began unlocking the various locks.
I gotta stop him! He's slashing all my tires! I don't have insurance!
Arctor stopped her. My car's there, too. He did not have his gun with him, of course, and Dan had the case knife and was out of control.
Tires aren't... My tires!
Shrieking, the girl struggled to open the door.
That's what he wants you to do, Arctor said.
Downstairs, Kimberly panted. We can phone the police. They have phone. Let me go!
She fought him off with tremendous strength and managed to get the door open.
I'm going to call the police. My tires! One of them is new!
I'll go with you.
He grabbed her by the shoulder. She tumbled ahead of him down the steps and he barely managed to catch up. Already she had reached the next apartment and was pounding on its door.
Open, please!
she called.
Please! I want to call the police! Please let me call the police!
Arctor got up beside her and knocked.
We need to use your phone, he said. It's an emergency.
An elderly man, wearing a gray sweater and creased formal slacks and a tie, opened the door.
Thanks, Arctor said.
Kimberly pushed inside, ran to the phone, and dialed the operator. Arctor stood facing the door, waiting for Dan to show up. There was no sound now, except for Kimberly babbling at the operator, a garbled account, something about a quarrel about a pair of boots worth $7.
He said they were his because I got them for him for Christmas, she was babbling. But because they were mine, I paid for them, and then he started to take them, and I ripped the backs of them with a can opener, so he...
She paused, then nodding.
All right, thank you. Yes, I'll hold on.
The elderly man gazed at Arctor, who gazed back. In the next room, an elderly lady in a print dress watched silently, her face stiff with fear.
This must be bad on you, Arctor said to the two elderly people.
Oh, it goes on all the time, the elderly man said. We hear them all night, night after night, fighting and him saying all the time he'll kill her.
We should have gone back to Denver, the elderly lady said. I told you that. We should have moved back.
Oh, these terrible fights, the elderly man said. And smashing things and the noise.
He gazed at Arctor, stricken, appealing for help, maybe, or maybe understanding.
On and on, it never does stop. And then what is worse, you know that every time...
Yes, tell him that,
the elderly lady urged.
What is worse, the elderly man said with dignity, is that every time we go outdoors, we go outside to shop or mail a letter, we step in, you know, with the dogs leave.
Dog do,
the elderly lady said with indignation. A local police car showed up. Arctor gave his deposition as a witness without identifying himself as a law enforcement officer. The cop took down his statement and tried to take one from Kimberly as the complaining party, but what she said made no sense. She rambled on and on about the pair of boots and why she'd gotten them, how much they meant to her. The cop, sitting with his clipboard and sheet, glanced up once at Arctor and regarded him with a cold expression that Arctor could not read but did not like anyhow. The cop finally advised Kimberly to get a phone and to call if the suspect returned and made any more trouble.
Oh, did you note the slashed tires?
Arctor said as the cop started to leave.
Did you examine her vehicle out there on the lot and note personally the number of tires slashed?
Casing slashes with a sharp instrument, recently made.
There's still some air leaking out?
The cop glanced at him again with the same expression and left with no further comment.
You better not stay here, Arctor said to Kimberly. He should have advised you to clear out. I asked if there was some other place you could stay.
Kimberly sat on her seedy couch in her debris-littered living room, her eyes lusterless again, now that she had ceased the futile effort of trying to explain her situation to the investigating officer. She shrugged.
I'll drive you somewhere, Arctor said. Do you know some friend you could...
Get the fuck out!
Kimberly said abruptly with venom, in a voice much like Dan Mancher's, but more raspy.
Get the fuck out of here, Bob Arctor! Get lost! Get lost! God damn it! Will you get lost?
Her voice rose shrilly and then broke in despair. He left and walked slowly back down the stairs, step by step. When he reached the bottom step, something banged and rolled down after him. It was the can of Drano. He heard her door lock, one bolt after another. Futile locks, he thought. Futile everything. The investigating officer advises her to call if the suspect returns. How can she without going out of her apartment? And there, Dan Mancher will stab her like he did the tires. And, remembering the complaint of the old folks downstairs, she will probably first step on and then fall dead into dog shit. He felt like laughing hysterically at the old folks' priorities. Not only did a burned-out freak upstairs night after night beat up and threatened to kill and probably would soon kill a young girl addict turning tricks, who no doubt had strep throat, if not much else besides, but in addition to that... As he drove Luckman and Barris back north, he chuckled aloud.
Dog shit, he said. Dog shit.
Humor and dog shit, he thought, if you can flash on it.
Funny dog shit.
Better change lanes and pass that Safeway truck, Luckman said. The hump is hardly moving.
He moved into the lane to the left and picked up speed. But then, when he took his foot off the throttle, the pedal all at once fell to the floor mat, and at the same time the engine roared all the way up furiously and the car shot forward at enormous, wild speed. "Slow down," both Luckman and Barris said together. By now the car had reached almost 100. Ahead, a VW van loomed. His gas pedal was dead. It did not return, and it did nothing. Both Luckman, who sat next to him, and Barris, beyond him, threw up their arms instinctively. Arctor twisted the wheel and shot by the VW van to its left, where a limited space remained before a fast-moving Vette filled it up. The Corvette honked, and they heard its brakes screech. Now Luckman and Barris were yelling. Luckman suddenly reached and shut off the ignition. Meanwhile, Arctor shifted out of gear into neutral. The car slowed, and he braked it down, moved into the right-hand lane, and then, with the engine finally dead and the transmission out of gear, rolled off onto the emergency strip and came by degrees to a stop. The Corvette, long gone down the freeway, still honked its indignation, and now the giant Safeway truck rolled by them and for a deafening moment sounded its own warning air horn.
"What the hell happened?" Barris said.
Arctor, his hands and voice and the rest of him shaking, said, "The return spring on the throttle cable, the gas. It must have caught or broken." He pointed down. They all peered at the pedal, which lay still flat against the floor. The engine had revved up to its entire maximum RPM, which for his car was considerable. He had not clocked their final highest road speed, probably well over 100. And, he realized, though he had been reflexively pushing down on the power brakes, the car had only slowed. Silently, the three of them got onto the emergency pavement and raised the hood. White smoke drifted up from the oil caps and from underneath as well, and near-boiling water fizzled from the overflow spout of the radiator. Luckman reached over the hot engine and pointed.
Not the spring, he said. It's the linkage from the pedal to the carb. See? Fell apart.
The long rod lay aimlessly against the block, hanging impotently and uselessly down with its locking ring still in place.
So the gas pedal didn't push back up when you took your foot off. But,
he inspected the carb for a time, his face wrinkled.
There's a safety override on the carb, Barris said, grinning and showing his synthetic-like teeth. This system, when the linkage parts...
Why'd it part? Arctor broke in. Shouldn't this locking ring hold the nut in place? He stroked along the rod. How could it just fall off like that? As if not hearing him, Barris continued.
If, for any reason, the linkage gives, then the engine should drop down to idle as a safety factor.
But it revved up all the way instead. He bent his body around to get a better look at the carb.
This screw has been turned all the way out, he said.
The idle screw, so that when the linkage parted, the override went the other way, up instead of down.
Well, how could that happen? Luckman said loudly. Could it screw itself all the way out like that accidentally?
Without answering, Barris got out his pocket knife, opened the small blade, and began slowly screwing the idle adjustment screw back in. He counted aloud, 20 turns of the screw to get it in.
To loosen the lock ring and nut assembly that holds the accelerator linkage rods together, he said, a special tool would be needed. A couple, in fact. I'd estimate it'll take about half an hour to get this back together. I have the tools, though, in my toolbox.
Your toolbox is back at the house, Luckman said.
Yes, Barris nodded. Then we'll have to get to a gas station and either borrow theirs or get their tow truck out here. I suggest we get them out here to look it over before we drive it again.
Hey, man. Luckman said loudly. Did this happen by accident, or was this done deliberately, like self-scope?
Barris pondered, still smiling his wily, rueful smile.
I couldn't say for sure about this. Normally, sabotage on a car, malicious damage to cause an accident.
He glanced at Arctor, his eyes invisible behind his green shades.
We almost piled up. If that Vette had been coming any faster, there was almost no ditch to head for. You should have cut the ignition as soon as you realized that happened.
I got it out of gear, Arctor said, when I realized.
For a second, I couldn't figure it out. He thought if it had been the brakes, if the brake pedal had gone to the floor, I'd have flashed on it sooner, known better what to do. But this was so weird.
Someone deliberately did it, Luckman said loudly. He spun around in a circle of fury, lashing out with both fists. Motherfucker! We almost bought it! They fucking almost got us!
Barris, standing visible by the side of the freeway with all its heavy traffic whizzing by, got out a little horn snuffbox of death tabs and took several. He passed the snuffbox to Luckman, who took a few, then passed it to Arctur.
Maybe that's what's fucking us up, Arctur said, declining irritably. Messing up our brains.
Dope can't screw up an accelerator linkage and carb idle adjustment, Barris said, still holding the snuffbox out to Arctur.
You'd better drop at least three of these. They're primo, but mild, cut with a little meth.
Put the damn snuffbox away, Arctur said. He felt in his head loud voices singing, terrible music, as if the reality around him had gone sour. Everything now. The fast-moving cars, the two men, his own car with its hood up, the smell of smog, the bright, hot light of midday. It all had a rancid quality, as if, throughout, his world had putrefied, rather than anything else. Not so much become all at once, because of this, dangerous, not frightening, but more as if rotting away, stinking in sight and sound and odor. It made him sick, and he shut his eyes and shuddered.
What do you smell? Luckman asked. A clue, man? Some engine smell that...
Dog shit, Arctur said. He could smell it, from within the engine area. Bending, he sniffed, smelled it distinctly and more strongly.
Weird, he thought. Freaky and fucking weird. Do you smell dog shit?
He asked Barris and Luckman.
No, Luckman said, eyeing him. To Barris, he said, were there any psychedelics in that dope?
Barris, smiling, shook his head. As he bent over the hot engine, smelling dog shit, Arctur knew to himself that it was an illusion. There was no dog shit smell. But still he smelled it. And now he saw, smeared across the motor block, especially down low by the plugs, dark brown stains, an ugly substance. Oil, he thought. Spilled oil, thrown oil. I may have a leaky head gasket. But he needed to reach down and touch, to be sure. To fortify his rational conviction. His fingers met the sticky brown smears, and his fingers leaped back. He had run his fingers into dog shit. There was a coating of dog shit all over the block, on the wires. Then he realized it was on the firewall as well. Looking up, he saw it on the soundproofing underneath the hood. The stink overpowered him, and he shut his eyes, shuddering.
"Hey, man," Luckman said acutely, taking hold of Arctur by the shoulder. "You're getting a flashback, aren't you?"
Free theater tickets, Barris agreed and chuckled.
You better sit down, Luckman said.
He guided Arctur back to the driver's seat and got him seated there.
Man, you're really freaked. Just sit there, take it easy. Nobody got killed, and now we're warned.
He shut the car door beside Arctur.
We're okay now, Dig.
Barris appeared at the window and said,
Want a lump of dog shit, Bob, to chew on?
Opening his eyes, chilled, Arctur stared at him. Barris's green glass eyes gave nothing back, no clue.
Did he really say that, Arctur wondered, or did my head make that up?
What, Jim? He said.
Barris began to laugh, and laugh, and laugh.
Leave him alone, man, Luckman said, punching Barris on the back. Fuck off, Barris.
Arctur said to Luckman,
What did he say just now? What the hell exactly did he say to me?
I don't know, Luckman said.
I can't figure out half the things Barris lays on people.
Barris still smiled, but had become silent.
You goddamn Barris, Arctur said to him. I know you did it. Screwed over the cephscope, and now the car. You fucking did it, you kinky freak mother bastard.
His voice was hardly audible to him, but as he yelled that out at smiling Barris, the dreadful stench of dog shit grew. He gave up trying to speak, and sat there at the useless wheel of his car trying not to throw up.
Thank God Luckman came along, he thought. Or it'd be all over for me this day. It'd all fucking be over at the hands of this burned-out fucking creep, this mother living right in the same house with me. Take it easy, Bob. Luckman's voice filtered to him through the waves of nausea. I know it's him, Arctor said. Well, hell, why? Luckman seemed to be saying, or trying to say. He'd have snuffed himself too this way. Why, man, why? The smell of Barris still smiling overpowered Bob Arctor, and he heaved onto the dashboard of his own car. A thousand little voices tinkled up, shining at him, and the smell receded finally. A thousand little voices crying out their strangeness. He did not understand them, but at least he could see, and the smell was going away. He trembled and reached for his handkerchief from his pocket. "What was in those tabs you gave us?" Luckman demanded at smiling Barris. "Hell, I dropped some, too," Barris said. "And so did you. And it didn't give us a bad trip, so it wasn't the dope. And it was too soon. How could it have been the dope? The stomach can't absorb—" "You poisoned me!" Arctor said savagely, his vision almost clear, his mind clearing, except for the fear. Now fear had begun, a rational response instead of insanity. Fear about what had almost happened, what it signified. Fear, fear. Terrible fear of smiling Barris and his fucking snuffbox and his explanations and his creepy sayings and ways and habits and customs and comings and goings. And his anonymous phoned-in tip to the police about Robert Arctor, his Mickey Mouse grid to conceal his real voice that had pretty well worked. Except that it had to have been Barris. Bob Arctor thought, the fucker is on to me. I never saw anybody space out as fast, Barris was saying. But then... You okay now, Bob? Luckman said. Well, clean up the barf, no trouble. Better get in the back seat. Both he and Barris opened the car door. Arctor slid dizzily out. To Barris, Luckman said, you sure you didn't slip him anything? Barris waved his hands up high, protesting. Chapter 6 Item. What an undercover narcotics agent fears most is not that he will be shot or beaten up, but that he will be slipped a great hit of some psychedelic that will roll an endless horror feature film in his head for the remainder of his life. Or that he will be shot up with a max head, half heroin and half substance D. Or both of the above, plus a poison such as strychnine, which will nearly kill him but not completely, so that the above can occur. Lifelong addiction, lifelong horror film. He will sink into a needle-in-a-spoon existence, or bounce off the walls in a psychiatric hospital, or, worst of all, a federal clinic. He will try to shake the aphids off him day and night, or puzzle forever over why he cannot any longer wax a floor. And all this will occur deliberately. Someone figured out what he was doing, and then got him. And they got him this way, the worst way of all, with the stuff they sell that he was after them for selling. Which, Bob Arctor considered as he cautiously drove home, meant that both the dealers and the narcs knew what the street drugs did to people. On that, they agreed. A Union Station mechanic near where they had parked had driven out and gone over the car and finally fixed it up at a cost of $30. Nothing else seemed wrong, except that the mechanic had examined the left front suspension for quite a while. Anything wrong there? Arctor had asked. Seems like you should be experiencing trouble when you corner sharply, the mechanic had said. Does it yaw at all? The car didn't yaw, not that Arctor had noticed. But the mechanic refused to say more. He just kept poking at the coil spring and ball joint and oil-filled shock. Arctor paid him, and the tow truck drove off. He then got back into his own car, along with Luckman and Barris, both of whom now rode in back, and started north toward Orange County. As he drove, Arctor ruminated about other ironic agreements in the minds of narcotics agents and dealers. Several narcotics agents that he had known had posed as dealers in their undercover work and wound up selling like hash and then sometimes even smack. This was a good cover, but it also brought the narc a gradually increasing profit over and above his official salary, plus what he made when he helped bust and seize a good-sized shipment. Also, the agents got deeper and deeper into using their own stuff,
the whole way of life, as a matter of course. They became rich dealer addicts as well as narcs. And after a time, some of them began to phase out their law enforcement activities in favor of full-time dealing. But then, too, certain dealers, to burn their enemies or when expecting imminent busts, began narking and went that route, winding up as sort of unofficial undercover narcs. It all got murky. The drug world was a murky world for everyone anyhow. For Bob Arctor, for example, it had become murky now. During this afternoon along the San Diego freeway, while he and his two buddies had been within foot seconds of being wiped out, the authorities, on his behalf, had been, he hoped, properly bugging their house. And if this had been done, then possibly he would be safe from now on from the kind of thing that had happened today. It was a piece of luck that ultimately might mean the difference between him winding up poisoned or shot or addicted or dead, compared to him nailing his enemy, nailing whoever was after him, and who today had in fact almost gotten him. Once the holo scanners were mounted in place, he ruminated, there would be very little sabotage or attacks against him. Or anyhow, successful sabotage or successful attacks. This was about the only thought that reassured him. The guilty, he reflected as he drove amid the heavy late afternoon traffic as carefully as possible, may flee when no one pursues. He had heard that, and maybe that was true. What for a certainty was true, however, was that the guilty fled like hell and took plenty of swift precautions when someone did pursue. Someone real and expert and at the same time hidden. And very close by. As close, he thought, as the back seat of this car. Where, if he has his funky .22 single-action German-made nowhere pistol with him and his equally funky, rinky-dink, laughable, alleged silencer on it, and Luckman has gone to sleep as usual, he can put a hollow-nosed bullet through the back of my skull and I will be as dead as Bobby Kennedy, who died from gunshot wounds of the same caliber. A bore that small. And not only today, but every day. And every night. Except that in the house, when I check the storage drums of the hollow scanners, I'll pretty well know pretty soon what everyone in my house is doing, and when they do it, and probably even why, myself included. I will watch all the rooms on a 24-hour basis, although there will be a lag. It won't help me much if the hollow scanners pick up me being given a hot shot of some disorientation drug ripped off by the Hell's Angels from a military arsenal and dumped in my coffee. Someone else from the academy who goes over the storage rooms will have to watch my thrashing around, unable to see or know where or what I am anymore. It will be a hindsight I won't even get to have. Somebody else will have to have it for me. Luckman said, I wonder what's been going on back at the house while we've been gone all day. You know, this proves you got somebody out to burn you real bad, Bob. I hope when we get back the house is still there. Yeah, Arctor said. I didn't think of that, and we didn't get a lone Cephscope anyhow. He made his voice sound leaden with resignation. Barris said in a surprisingly cheerful voice, I wouldn't worry too much. With anger, Luckman said, You wouldn't? Christ, they may have broken in and ripped off all we got, all Bob's got anyhow, and killed or stomped the animals, or... I left a little surprise, Barris said, for anybody entering the house while we're gone today. I perfected it early this morning. I worked until I got it. An electronic surprise. Sharply, concealing his concern, Arctor said, What kind of electronic surprise? It's my house, Jim. You can't start rigging up... Easy, easy, Barris said. As our German friends would say, Leise. Which means be cool. What is it? If the front door is opened, Barris said, during our absence, my cassette tape recorder starts recording. It's under the couch. It has a 2-hour tape. I placed 3 omnidirectional Sony mics at 3 different... You should have told me, Arctor said. What if they come in through the windows, Luckman said, or the back door? To increase the chances of their making their entry via the front door, Barris continued, rather than in other less usual ways, I providentially left the front door unlocked. After a pause, Luckman began to snigger. Suppose they don't know it's unlocked, Arctor said. I put a note on it, Barris said.
You're jiving me. Yes, Barris said presently. Are you fucking jiving us or not? Luckman said.
I can't tell with you. Is he jiving, Bob?
We'll see when we get back, Arctor said. If there's a note in the door and it's unlocked, we'll know he isn't jiving us. They probably would take the note down, Luckman said, after ripping off and vandalizing the house, and then lock the door. So we won't know. We'll never know, for sure. It's that gray area again. Of course I'm kidding, Barris said with vigor. Only a psychotic would do that. Leave the front door of his house unlocked and a note on the door. Turning, Arctor said to him, What did you write on the note, Jim?
Hey, who's the note to? Luckman chimed in. I didn't even know you knew how to write.
With condescension, Barris said, I wrote, Donna, come on inside. Door's unlocked.
Oh, Barris broke off. It's to Donna, he finished, but not smoothly.
He did do that, Luckman said. He really did, all of it.
That way, Barris said smoothly again, we'll know who had been doing this, Bob, and that's of prime importance.
Unless they rip off the tape recorder when they rip off the couch and everything else, Arctor said. He was thinking rapidly as to how much of a problem this really was. This additional example of Barris's messed-up electronic nowhere genius of a kindergarten sort. Hell, he concluded. They'll find the mics in the first 10 minutes and trace them back to the recorder. They'll know exactly what to do. They'll erase the tape, rewind it, leave it as it was, leave the door unlocked, and the note on it. In fact, maybe the unlocked door will make their job easier. Fucking Barris, he thought. Great genius plans, which will work out so as to screw up the universe. He probably forgot to plug the recorder into the wall outlet anyhow. Of course, if he finds it unplugged, he'll reason that proves someone was there, he realized. He'll flash on that and rap at us for days. Somebody got in, it was hip to his device, and cleverly unplugged it. So, he decided, if they find it unplugged, I hope they think to plug it in, and not only that, make it run right. In fact, what they really should do is test out his whole detection system, run it through its cycle as thoroughly as they do their own, be absolutely certain it functions perfectly, and then wind it back to a blank state. A tablet on which nothing is inscribed, but on which something would for sure be had anyone, themselves, for example, entered the house. Otherwise, Barris's suspicions will be aroused forever. As he drove, he continued his theoretical analysis of his situation by means of a second well-established example. They had brought it up and drilled it into his own memory banks during his police training at the academy. Or else he had read it in the newspapers. Item. One of the most effective forms of industrial or military sabotage limits itself to damage that can never be thoroughly proven, or even proven at all, to be anything deliberate. It is like an invisible political movement. Perhaps it isn't there at all. If a bomb is wired to a car's ignition, then obviously there is an enemy. If a public building or a political headquarters is blown up, then there is a political enemy. But if an accident or a series of accidents occurs, if equipment merely fails to function, if it appears faulty, especially in a slow fashion over a period of natural time, with numerous small failures and misfirings, then the victim, whether a person or a party or a country, can never marshal itself to defend itself. In fact, Arctor speculated as he drove along the freeway very slowly, the person begins to assume he's paranoid and has no enemy. He doubts himself. His car broke down normally. His luck has just become bad, and his friends agree. It's in his head. And this wipes him out more thoroughly than anything that can be traced. However, it takes longer. The person or persons doing him in must tinker and putter and make use of chance over a long interval. Meanwhile, if the victim can figure out who they are, he has a better chance of getting them. Certainly better than if, say, they shoot him with a scope sight rifle. That is his advantage. Every nation in the world, he knew, trains and sends out a mass of agents to loosen bolts here, strip threads there, break wires, and start little fires, lose documents, little misadventures. A wad of gum inside a Xerox copying machine in a government office can destroy an irreplaceable and vital document. Instead of a copy coming out, the original is wiped out. Too much soap and toilet paper, as the yippies of the 60s knew, can screw up the entire sewage of an office building and force all the employees out for a week. A mothball in a car's gas tank wears out the engine 2 weeks later, when it's in another town, and leaves no fuel contaminants to be analyzed. Any radio or TV station can be put off the air by a pile driver accidentally cutting a microwave cable or a power cable, and so forth. Many of the previous aristocratic social class knew about maids and gardeners and other serf-type help. A broken vase here, a dropped priceless heirloom that slips out of a sullen hand.
Why'd you do that, Rastus Brown?
Oh, I just forgot to...
And there was no recourse, or very little. By a rich homeowner, by a political writer unpopular with the regime, a small new nation shaking its fist at the U.S. or at the USSR. Once, an American ambassador to Guatemala had had a wife who had publicly boasted that her pistol-packing husband had overthrown that little nation's left-wing government. After its abrupt fall, the ambassador, his job done, had been transferred to a small Asian nation, and while driving a sports car, he had suddenly discovered a slow-moving hay truck pulling out of a side road directly ahead of him. A moment later, nothing remained of the ambassador except a bunch of splatted bits. Packing a pistol and having at his call an entire CIA-raised private army had done him no good. His wife wrote no proud poetry about that.
Do what?
The owner of the hay truck had probably said to the local authorities.
Do what, massa? I just...
Or like his own ex-wife, Arctur remembered. At that time, he had worked for an insurance firm as an investigator.
Do your neighbors across the hall drink a lot?
And she had objected to his filling out his reports late at night instead of thrilling at the very sight of her. Toward the end of their marriage, she had learned to do such things during his late-night work period as burn her hand while lighting a cigarette, get something in her eye, dust his office, or search forever throughout or around his typewriter for some little object. At first, he had resentfully stopped work and succumbed to thrilling at the very sight of her. But then, he had hit his head in the kitchen while getting out the corn popper and had found a better solution.
They kill our animals, Lockman was saying. I'll firebomb them. I'll get all of them. I'll hire a professional down from L.A., like a bunch of panthers.
They won't, Barris said. There's nothing to be gained by injuring animals. The animals haven't done anything.
Have I? Arctur said.
Evidently they think so, Barris said. Lockman said, if I had known it was harmless, I would have killed it myself.
Remember?
But she was a straight, Barris said. That girl never turned on, and she had heavy bread. You remember her apartment? The rich never understand the value of life. That's something else. Remember Thelma Cornford, Bob? The short girl with huge breasts. She never wore a bra, and we used to just sit and look at her nipples.
Yeah, she came over to our place to get us to kill that mosquito hawk for her. And when we explained...
At the wheel of his slow car, Bob Arctur forgot theoretical matters and did a rerun of a moment that had impressed them all. The dainty and elegant straight girl in her turtleneck sweater and bell-bottoms and trippy boobs who wanted them to murder a great harmless bug that in fact did good by wiping out mosquitoes. And in a year in which an outbreak of encephalitis had been anticipated in Orange County, and when they saw what it was and explained, she had said words that became for them their parody evil wall motto, to be feared and despised.
If I had known it was harmless, I would have killed it myself.
That had summed up to them, and still did, what they distrusted in their straight foes, assuming they had foes. Anyhow, a person like well-educated with all the financial advantages, Thelma Cornford, became at once a foe by uttering that, from which they had run that day, pouring out of her apartment and back to their own littered pad, to her perplexity. The gulf between their world and hers had manifested itself, however much they'd meditated on how to ball her, and remained. Her heart, Bob Arctor reflected, was an empty kitchen, floor tile and water pipes, and a drain board with pale scrubbed surfaces, and one abandoned glass on the edge of the sink that nobody cared about. One time before he got solely into undercover work, he had taken a deposition from a pair of upper-class, well-off straights whose furniture had been ripped off during their absence, evidently by junkies. In those days, such people still lived in areas where roving rip-off bands stole what they could, leaving little. Professional bands, with walkie-talkies in the hands of spotters who watched a couple of miles down the street for the mark's return. He remembered the man and his wife saying, "People who would burglarize your house and take your color TV are the same kinds of criminals who slaughter animals or vandalize priceless works of art." "No," Bob Arctor had explained, pausing and writing down their deposition. "What makes you believe that?" Addicts, in his experience anyhow, rarely hurt animals. He had witnessed junkies feeding and caring for injured animals over long periods of time, where straights probably would have had the animals put to sleep, a straight-type term if there ever was one, and also an old syndicate term as well for murder. Once he had assisted two totally spaced-out heads in the sad ordeal of unscrewing a cat which had impaled herself within a broken window. The heads, hardly able to see or understand anything anymore, had over almost an entire hour deftly and patiently worked the cat loose until she was free, bleeding a little, all of them, heads and cat alike, with the cat calm in their hands, one dude inside the house with Arctor, and the other outdoors, where the ass and tail were. The cat had come free at last, with no real injury, and then they had fed her. They did not know whose cat she was. Evidently she had been hungry and smelled food through their broken window, and finally, unable to rouse them, had tried to leap in. They hadn't noticed her until her shriek, and then they had forgotten their various trips and dreams for a while, in her behalf. As to priceless works of art, he wasn't too sure, because he didn't exactly understand what that meant. At My Lai, during the Vietnam War, 450 priceless works of art had been vandalized to death at the orders of the CIA. Priceless works of art, plus oxen and chickens and other animals not listed. When he thought about that, he always got a little dingy, and was hard to reason with about paintings in museums like that. "Do you think," he said aloud as he painstakingly drove, "that when we die and appear before God on Judgment Day, that our sins will be listed in chronological order or in order of severity, which could be ascending or descending, or alphabetically? Because I don't want to have God boom out at me when I die at the age of 86. So you're the little boy who stole the 3 Coke bottles off the Coca-Cola truck when it was parked in the 7-Eleven lot back in 1962, and you've got a lot of fast talking to do." "Well, I think they're cross-referenced," Luckman said. "And they just hand you a computer printout that's a total of a long column that's been added up already." "Sin," Barris said, chuckling, "is a Jewish-Christian myth that is outdated." Arctor said, "And maybe they've got all your sins in one big pickle barrel." He turned to glare at Barris, the anti-Semite. "A kosher pickle barrel, and they just hoist it up and throw the whole contents all at once in your face. And you just stand there, dripping sins. Your own sins. Plus, maybe a few of somebody else's that got in by mistake." "Somebody else by the same name," Luckman said. "Another Robert Arctor." "How many Robert Arctors do you think there are, Barris?" He nudged Barris. "Could the Caltech computers tell us that? And cross-file all the Jim Barrises, too, while they're doing it?" To himself, Bob Arctor thought, "How many Bob Arctors are there?" A weird and fucked-up thought. "Two that I can think of," he thought. "The one called Fred, who will be watching the other one, called Bob. The same person. Or is it? Is Fred actually the same as Bob? Does anybody know? I would know if anyone did, because I'm the only person in the world that knows that Fred is Bob Arctor. But," he thought, "who am I? Which of them is me?" When they rolled to a stop in the driveway, parked, and walked warily toward the front door, they found Barris's note and the door unlocked. But when they cautiously opened the door, everything appeared as it had been when they left. Barris's suspicions surfaced instantly,
Ah, he murmured, entering. He swiftly reached to the top of the bookshelf by the door and brought down his .22 pistol, which he gripped as the other men moved about. The animals approached them as usual, clamoring to be fed.
Well, Barris, Luckman said, I can see you're right. Oh, there definitely was someone here, because you see too, don't you, Bob? The scrupulous covering over of all the signs they would have otherwise left testifies to their...
He farted then, in disgust, and wandered into the kitchen to look in the refrigerator for a can of beer.
Barris, he said, you're fucked.
Still moving about alertly with his gun, Barris ignored him as he sought to discover telltale traces. Arctor, watching, thought, maybe he will. They may have left some. And he thought, strange how paranoia can link up with reality now and then, briefly. Under very specialized conditions, such as today. Next thing, Barris will be reasoning that I lured everyone out of the house deliberately to permit secret intruders to accomplish their thing here. And later on, he will discern why and who and everything else, and in fact, maybe he already has. Had a while ago, in fact. Long enough ago to initiate sabotage and destruct actions on the Cephscope, car, and God knows what else. Maybe when I turn on the garage light, the house will burn down. But the main thing is, did the bugging crew arrive and get all the monitors in and finish up? He would not know until he talked to Hank. And Hank gave him a proof-positive layout of the monitors and where their storage drums could be serviced. And whatever additional information the bugging crew's boss, plus other experts involved in this operation, wanted to dump on him, in their concerted play against Bob Arctor, the suspect.
Look at this,
Barris said. He bent over an ashtray on the coffee table.
Come here,
he called sharply to both of them, and both men responded. Reaching down, Arctor felt heat rising from the ashtray.
A still hot cigarette butt, Buckman said, marveling. It sure is. Jesus, Arctor thought. They did screw up.
One of the crew smoked and then reflexively put the butt here. So they must have just gone. The ashtray, as always, overflowed. The crewmen probably assumed no one would notice the addition. And in another few moments, it would have cooled.
Wait a second, Luckman said, examining the ashtray.
He fished out from among the tobacco butts a roach.
This is what's hot, is roach. They lit a joint while they were here. But what'd they do? What the hell did they do?
He scowled and peered about, angry and baffled.
Bob, fuck it. Barris was right. There was somebody here. This roach is still hot. You can smell it if you hold it.
He held it under Arctor's nose.
Yeah, it's still burning a little down inside. Probably a seed. They didn't manicure it too good before they rolled it.
That roach, Barris said, equally grim, may not have been left here by accident. This evidence may not be a slip-up.
What now? Arctor said. Wondering what kind of police bugging crew would have a member who smoked a joint in front of the others while on the job.
Maybe they were here specifically to plant dope in this house, Barris said, setting us up, then phone in a tip later. Maybe there's dope hidden like this in the phone, for example, in the wall outlets. We're going to have to go through the whole house and get it absolutely clean before they phone the tip in. And we've probably got only hours.
You check the wall circuits. Luckman said. I'll take the phone apart.
Wait,
Barris said, holding up his hand. If they see us scrambling around just before the raid...
What raid? Arctor said. If we're running frantically around flushing dope, Barris said, then we can't allege, even though it's true, that we didn't know the dope was there. They'll catch us actually holding it. And maybe that, too, is part of their plan.
Ah, shit, Luckman said in disgust.
He threw himself down on the couch.
Shit, shit, shit. We can't do anything. There's probably dope hidden in 1,000 places we'll never find. We've had it.
He glared up at Arctor in baffled fury.
We've had it.
Arctor said to Barris, what about your electronic cassette thing rigged to the front door? He had forgotten about it. So had Barris, evidently. Luckman, too.
Yes, this should be extremely informational at this point, Barris said.
He knelt down by the couch, reached underneath, grunted, then hauled forth a small plastic cassette tape recorder.
"Oh, this should tell us a great deal," he began,
and then his face sank.
"Well, it probably wouldn't ultimately have proven that important."
He pulled out the power plug from the back and set the cassette down on the coffee table.
"We know the main fact, that they did enter during our absence. That was its main task."
Silence. "I bet I can guess," Arctor said. Barris said,
"The first thing they did when they entered was to switch it to the off position. I left it set to on, but look, now it's turned to off. So, although I..."
"It didn't record," Luckman said, disappointed.
"They made their move swiftly," Barris said, "before so much as an inch of tape passed through the recording head. This, by the way, is a neat little job of Sony. It has a separate head for playback, erase and record, and the Dolby noise reduction system. I got it cheap, at a swap meet, and it's never given me any trouble."
Arctor said, "Mandatory soul time."
"Absolutely,"
Barris agreed as he seated himself in a chair and leaned back, removing his shades.
"At this point, we have no other recourse in view of their evasive tactics. You know, Bob, there is one thing you could do, although it would take time."
"Sell the house and move out," Arctor said. Barris nodded.
"Oh, but hell," Luckman protested. "This is our home." "What are houses like this in this area worth now?" Barris asked, hands behind his head. "On the market. I wonder, too, what interest rates are up to. Maybe you can make a considerable profit, Bob. On the other hand, you might have to take a loss on a quick sale." "But, Bob, my God, you're up against professionals."
"Do you know a good realtor?"
Luckman asked both of them.
Arctor said, "What reason should we give for selling? They always ask."
"Yeah, we can't tell the realtor the truth," Luckman agreed.
"But we could say..." He pondered as he moodily drank his beer. "I can't think of a reason. Barris, what's a reason, a shuck, we could give?"
Arctor said, "We'll just say, flat out, there's narcotics planted all over the house, and since we don't know where it is, we decided to move out and let the new owner get busted instead of us."
"No," Barris disagreed. "I don't think we can afford to be up front like that. I'd suggest you say, Bob, you say that you got a job transfer."
"Where to?"
Luckman said.
"Cleveland," Barris said.
"Well, I think we should tell them the truth," Arctor said. "In fact, we could put an ad in the L.A. Times. Modern three-bedroom tract house with two bathrooms for easy and fast flushing, high-grade dope stash throughout all rooms, dope included in sale price."
"But they'd be calling asking what kind of dope," Luckman said.
"And we don't know. It could be anything."
"And how much there is," Barris murmured. "Prospective buyers might inquire about the quantity."
"Like," Luckman said, "it could be an ounce of roach weed, just shit like that. Or it could be pounds of heroin."
"What I suggest," Barris said, "is that we phone County Drug Abuse and inform them of the situation and ask them to come in and remove the dope. Search the house, find it, dispose of it. Because, to be realistic, there really isn't time to sell the house. I researched the legal situation once for this type of bind, and most law books agree..."
"Are you crazy?" Luckman said, staring at him as if he were one of Jerry's aphids. "Phone drug abuse? There'll be narcs in here within less time than..."
"That's the best hope," Barris continued smoothly. "And we can all take lie detector tests to prove we didn't know where it was or what it was or even put it there. It is there without our knowledge or permission. If you tell them that, Bob, they'll exonerate you."
After a pause, he admitted, "Eventually, when all the facts are known in open court."
"But on the other hand," Luckman said, "we've got our own stashes. We do know where they are, and like that, does this mean we gotta flush all our stashes? And suppose we miss some, even one? Oh, Christ, this is awful."
"There's no way out," Arctor said. "They appear to have us."
From one of the bedrooms, Donna Hawthorne appeared, wearing a funny little knee-pants outfit, hair tumbled in disarray, her face puffy with sleep.
"I came on in," she said, "like the note said, and I sat around for a while and then crashed. The note didn't say when you'd be back,
Why were you yelling? God, you're uptight. You woke me. You smoked a joint just now? Arctur asked her. Before you crashed? Sure, she said. Otherwise I can't ever sleep.
It's Donna's roach, Luckman said. Give it to her.
My God, Bob Arctur thought. I was into that trip as much as they were. We all got into it together that deep. He shook himself, shuddered, and blinked. Knowing what I know, I still stepped across into that freaked-out, paranoid space with them, viewed it as they viewed it. Muddled, he thought. Murky again. The same murk that covers them covers me. The murk of this dreary dream world we float around in.
You got us out of it, he said to Donna.
Out of what?
Donna said, puzzled and sleepy.
Not what I am, he thought, or what I know was supposed to take place here today.
But this chick, she put my head back together, got all three of us out. A little black-haired chick, wearing a funky outfit, who I report on and am shucking and hopefully will be fucking. Another shuck-and-fuck reality world, he thought, with this foxy girl the center of it. A rational point that unwired us abruptly. Otherwise, where would our heads finally have gone? We, all three of us, had gotten out of it entirely. But not for the first time, he thought. Not even today.
You shouldn't leave your place unlocked like that, Donna said. You could get ripped off, and it'd be your own fault. Even the giant capitalist insurance companies say that if you leave a door or a window unlocked, they won't pay. That's the main reason I came in when I saw the note. Somebody ought to be here if it's unlocked like that.
How long you been here? Arctur asked her. Maybe she had aborted the bugging, maybe not. Probably not. Donna consulted her $20 electric Timex wristwatch, which he had given her.
About 38 minutes.
Hey! Her face brightened.
Bob, I got that wolf book with me. You want to look at it now? Oh, it's got a lot of heavy shit in it, if you can dig it.
Life, Barris said, as if to himself, is only heavy and none else. And there is only the one trip, all heavy. Heavy that leads to the grave. For everyone and everything.
Did I hear you say you're going to sell your house? Donna asked him. Or was that, you know, me dreaming? I couldn't tell. What I heard sounded spaced out and weird.
We're all dreaming, Arctur said. If the last to know he's an addict is the addict, then maybe the last to know when a man means what he says is the man himself, he reflected. He wondered how much of the garbage that Donna had overheard he had seriously meant. He wondered how much of the insanity of the day, his insanity, had been real, or just induced as a contact lunacy by the situation. Donna always was a pivot point of reality for him. For her, this was the basic, natural question. He wished he could answer. Chapter 7 The next day, Fred showed up in his scramble suit to hear about the bugging installation.
The 6 holo scanners now operating within the premises, 6 should be sufficient for now, we feel, transmit to a safe apartment down the street in the same block as Arctur's house, Hank explained, laying out a floor plan of Bob Arctur's house on the metal table between them. It chilled Fred to see this, but not overly much. He picked the sheet up and studied the locations of the various scanners in the various rooms, here and there, so that everything fell under constant video scrutiny, as well as audio.
So I do the playback at that apartment, Fred said.
Well, we use it as a playback monitor spot for about 8, or perhaps it's 9 now, houses or apartments under scrutiny in that particular neighborhood. So you'll be bumping into other undercover people doing their playbacks. Always have your suit on, then.
I'll be seen going into the apartment. It's too close.
Guess so, but it's an enormous complex, hundreds of units, and it's the only one we found electronically feasible. It'll have to do, at least until we get legal eviction on another unit elsewhere. We're working on it. 2 blocks farther away, where you'll be less conspicuous. Week or so, I guess. If holoscans could be transmitted with acceptable resolution along micro-relay cables and ITT lines like the older...
I'll just use the shuck that I'm bawling some broad in that complex if... Arctur or Luckman or any of those heads see me entering.
It really didn't complicate matters that much. In fact, it would cut down his in-transit unpaid time, which was an important factor. He could easily truck on over to the safe apartment, do the scanning replay, determine what was relevant to his reports and what could be discarded, and then return very soon to my own house, he thought. Arctor's house. Up the street at the house, I am Bob Arctor, the heavy doper suspect being scanned without his knowledge, and then every couple of days I find a pretext to slip down the street and into the apartment where I am Fred, replaying miles and miles of tape to see what I did, and this whole business, he thought, depresses me. Except for the protection and valuable personal information it will give me. Probably whoever's hunting me will be caught by the holoscanners within the first week. Realizing that, he felt mellow. Fine, he said to Hank.
So you see where the hollows are placed. If they need servicing, you probably can do it yourself while you're in Arctor's house and no one else is around. You do get into his house normally, don't you?
Well, shit, Fred thought. If I do that, then I will be on the hollow replays. So when I turn them over to Hank, I have to be obviously one of the individuals visible on them, and that cuts it down. Up to now, he had never actually laid it on Hank as to how he knew what he knew about his suspects. He himself as Fred, the effective screening device, carried the information. But now, audio and holo scanners, which did not automatically edit out as did his verbal report all identifying mention of himself, there would be Robert Arctor tinkering with the hollows when they malfunctioned, his face mushrooming up to fill the screen. But on the other hand, he would be the first to replay the storage tapes he could still edit. Except that it would take time and care. But edit out what? Edit out Arctor? Entirely? Arctor was the suspect. Just Arctor when he went to fiddle with the hollows. I'll edit myself out, he said, so you won't see me, as a matter of conventional protection.
Of course. You haven't done this before?
Hank reached to show him a couple of pictures.
You use a bulk erasing device that wipes out any section where you as the informant appear. That's the hollows, of course. For audio, there's no set policy followed. You won't have any real trouble, though. We take it for granted that you're one of the individuals in Arctor's circle of friends who frequent that house. You are either Jim Barris or Ernie Luckman or Charles Freck or Donna Hawthorne.
Donna? He laughed. The suit laughed, actually. In its way.
Or Bob Arctor,
Hank continued, studying his list of suspects. I report on myself all the time, Fred said.
So you will have to include yourself from time to time in the holotapes you turn over to us, because if you systematically edit yourself out, then we can deduce who you are by a process of elimination, whether we want to or not. What you must do, really, is edit yourself out in, what should I call it? An inventive, artistic, hell, the word is creative way. As, for instance, during the brief intervals when you're in the house alone and doing research, going through papers and drawers, or servicing a scanner within view of another scanner. Or,
you should just send someone to the house once a month in a uniform, Fred said, and have him say, good morning, I'm here to service the monitoring devices covertly installed on your premises, in your phone, and in your car. Maybe Arctor would pick up the bill.
Arctor would probably off him and then disappear.
The scramble suit, Fred said, if Arctor is hiding that much, that's not been proved.
Arctor may be hiding a great deal. We've got more recent information on him gathered and analyzed. There is no substantial doubt of it. He is a ringer, a $3 bill. He is phony. So keep on him until he drops, until we have enough to arrest him and make it stick.
You want stuff planted?
We'll discuss that later.
You think he's up high in the, the SD agency?
What we think isn't of any importance in your work,
Hank said.
We evaluate. You report with your own limited conclusions. This is not a put-down of you, but we have information, lots of it, not available to you. The broad picture, the computerized picture.
Arctor is doomed, Fred said, if he's up to anything. And I have a hunch from what you say that he is.
We should have a case on him this way soon, Hank said. And then we can close the book on him, which will please us all.
Fred stoically memorized the address and number of the apartment and suddenly recalled that he had seen a young head-type couple who had recently abruptly disappeared now and then entering and leaving the building. Busted. And their apartment taken over for this. He had liked them. The girl had long flaxen hair, wore no bra. One time he had driven past as she was lugging groceries and had offered her a lift. They had talked. She was an organic type, into megavitamins and kelp and sunlight. Nice, shy. But she declined. Now he could see why. Evidently, the two of them had been holding, or more likely, dealing. On the other hand, if the apartment was needed, a possession rap would do, and you could always get that. What, he wondered, would Bob Arctor's littered but large house be used for by the authorities when Arctor had been hauled off? An even vaster intelligence processing center, most likely. You'd like Arctor's house, he said aloud. It's run down and typically doper dirty, but it's big. Nice yard. Lots of shrubs.
That's what the installation crew reported back. Some excellent possibilities.
They what? They reported it had plenty of possibilities, did they? The scramble suit voice clacked out maddeningly without tone or resonance, which made him even angrier. Like what?
Well, one obvious possibility. Its living room gives a view of an intersection, so passing vehicles could be graphed in their license plates.
Hank studied his many, many papers.
But Bert What's-His-Face, who headed the crew, felt the house had been allowed to deteriorate so badly that it wouldn't be worth our taking over. As an investment.
In what way? In what fashion deteriorated?
The roof.
The roof's perfect.
The interior and exterior paint. The condition of the floors, the kitchen cabinets.
Bullshit, Fred said. Or anyhow, the suit droned. Arctor may have let dishes pile up in the garbage and not dusted, but after all, three dudes living there with no chicks? His wife left him. Women are supposed to do all that. If Donna Hawthorne had moved in like Arctor wanted her to, begged her to, she would have kept it up. Anyhow, any professional janitorial service could put the whole house in top shape as far as cleaning goes in half a day. Regarding the roof, that really makes me mad, because...
Then you recommend we acquire it after Arctor's been arrested and loses title.
Fred the suit stared at him.
Well?
Hank said impassively, ballpoint pen ready. I have no opinion, one way or another. Fred rose from his chair to leave.
Oh, you're not splitting yet,
Hank said, motioning him to reseat himself. He fished among the papers on his desk.
I have a memo here.
You always have memos, Fred said. For everybody.
This memo, Hank said, instructs me to send you over to room 203 before you leave today.
If it's about that anti-drug speech I gave at the Lions Club, I already had my ass chewed out about it.
No, this isn't that.
Hank tossed him the fluttery note.
This is something different. I'm finished with you, so why don't you head right over there now and get it done with?